WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Christmas is the time Santa is supposed to make a list and check it twice, but New Year's is the time for critics to make their lists, their 10 best lists. Our book critic John Leonard will join us later in this half hour to discuss his favorite books of the year and some of the most important issues of the year in the book world. With me now is our film critic, Stephen Schiff, to review the year in film. Stephen, let's get started on a dramatic note and have you reveal your 10 best list.
I'm so excited. All right. This is more fun than it ever should be. I mean, this is one of those really weird little things we critics do that we know is beneath us, but God, we love it. Starting with number 10, Bertrand Tavernier's movie Life and Nothing But is the only foreign film on my list, the only foreign language film on my list, that is. And I thought it was a beautiful, huge, sweeping romance of a kind that we rarely see anymore. That's number 10. Number 9, this will surprise you maybe, Gremlins 2. Joe Dante's sequel to Gremlins 1, much better movie than Gremlins 1, much more grown up, much funnier, crazier, and even rather avant-garde.
I'm surprised.
Good. Number 8, The Godfather Part 3, which is not everything that The Godfather Part 1 and 2 were, but is a Godfather movie, and if it doesn't quite measure up to the first two, really does have something very special about it. Number 7, Reversal of Fortune, which was very high on a lot of lists this year, the story of the Klaus von Bülow trial. Number 6, Vincent and Theo, Robert Altman's difficult, really strange film about Vincent van Gogh and his brother. Number 5, The Russia House, Fred Skepsy's version of the John le Carré novel, which I thought was really just about everything it needed to be. Not a spy versus spy movie, but a really wonderful cross-cultural romance. Number 4, The Grifters, Stephen Frears' movie, that not a lot of people around America have seen yet. It'll open in most places in January. It's a very, very dark film noir. Number 3, Miller's Crossing, another of the rash of gangster films, this one by the Coen brothers, a very mysterious, beautiful film, I thought. Number 2, opened last January, almost a year ago now, Sweetie, the New Zealand film by Jane Campion. And number 1... Do you have drum rolls? No. Okay. Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas.
Okay. Well, listen, when you add them all up, was it a good year for movies?
You know, I mean, after reading through the list, I say, well, these are a lot of movies I was excited about. But actually, I thought it was a pretty bad year for movies. And after those 10, the drop-off is immense. And even those 10, I mean, in a really good year, a lot of those wouldn't have made it. I thought the last several years were not bad for movies. I'm not someone who every year trundles in and says, God, this is the worst year ever. I didn't think that of the last few years, but this year I think was a sort of transitional, uneasy year when a lot of tendencies began to kick into gear that I find rather alarming.
Well, two of the real box office smashes of the year are not on your list, Ghost and Pretty Woman, two really kind of surprising smashes because they were romantic comedies and the big successes were supposed to be the high-tech adventure films. What do you make of the success of these movies, Stephen?
Well, I think there's a kind of new urge to create romances on the screen. And despite the success of those movies, I don't think people really know how to do it anymore. Those movies, of course, were sleepers. Their success partly reflects a kind of sickness unto death of these huge high-tech movies, which still did very well. Total Recall did very well. Die Hard 2 did very well. But the expectations for them have become so overblown that we have the perception that they weren't hits. They were. But there's a feeling that, well, you know, if you want to spend a little less money and just use that old sort of screen value of chemistry, you can have a huge hit, which seems to be the case with these movies. At the same time, you know, Hollywood is always trying to reinvent old movie styles, whether it's gangster movies, which we saw this year, or romances. And I have the feeling that instead of drawing from life the way the original makers of romances in the 30s and 40s did, now Hollywood is drawing from other movies, and you're getting a peculiarly synthetic, sort of unworkable kind of romance on the screen. These movies that you mentioned, Pretty Woman and Ghost, worked for some people, but the more sort of glaring synthetic kind of romances included things like Havana, which didn't work for very many people, White Palace, Green Card, which is now opening in some places. Dick Tracy had a kind of romantic heart that didn't work for me. Henry and June, of course. I mean, there's a feeling that if you put sort of a man and a woman together and you have them liking different foods or something and they like different kinds of cars, then some sparks will be created, and it's not true. That's not really what the essence of romance is. That's just a formula.
One trend in romance this year was that, you know, aging male actors were playing opposite women of the age these male actors played against when they started their careers. And, you know, as examples, I'd offer Warren Beatty opposite Madonna, Robert Redford opposite Lena Olin, Sean Connery opposite Michelle Pfeiffer. I think for a lot of women, we find this trend disturbing in the sense that, you know, you don't see women being able to do that. So, you know, women actors the age of Redford and Connery and Beatty aren't getting the roles. The romantic leads have a really narrow age range for women.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think this was a terrible year for actresses in the movies. It was very hard to come up with, you know, three or four, or let alone five, as the Academy has to come up with, terrific performances by actresses. And that's because there were very few opportunities for actresses in leading roles this year. The reason that you're not seeing good roles for actresses is partly box office. It's not perceived that actresses can open films by putting their name on marquees. Very few can. And those that seem to for a time don't have much longevity. Bette Midler, for instance. And part of that perception has to do less with American prejudices than international prejudices, because even if the American market could go for actresses on a marquee, the international market is perceived as not being able to. They will always go for a male star on a marquee. That's why you can market a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone or an Eddie Murphy universally, but you can't, you know, throw up Michelle Pfeiffer onto a marquee and expect that you're going to do big box office.
Well, isn't the international market mostly an action market?
It is largely an action market, and it's very star-oriented.
I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger saying or maybe it was Sylvester Stallone, it was one of them on Entertainment Tonight or one of those shows, talking about how all the international movies really relied on action, in part because they didn't want to rely too much on dialogue and subtitles or dubbing.
Yeah, I think that's partly true. And also, I mean, it's just an increasingly important part of the market. International movies are now, international revenues are now something like 50% of the market that a movie can expect. So that becomes a very important force.
This seemed like a big year for sequels, but I couldn't tell whether it was typical or atypical. I mean, were there more sequels this year than usual?
This was the biggest year for sequels ever. 25, a record.
That seems like a lot. That's more than one a month. Actually, it's at least two a month, if they were metered out equally every month, which they probably weren't.
Yeah, and you know, it reflects a lot of tendencies. It reflects some of the same tendencies that we're seeing in the huge takeovers of the movie companies. You know, Matsushita bought MCA Universal, and Pathé bought MGM, and not too long ago, Sony bought Columbia. And it reflects a kind of feeling of, let's run this as a business, let's make our bets safer, let's not take risks. You know, a sequel more or less has a built-in audience. At least it does for the opening weekend. The least a film can hope for on its road to success is to open. That opening weekend counts. A sequel can do much the same thing that a big star can do. He can bring people in at the beginning. And so that's why you see so many sequels, whether they work or not. But I was thinking of sequels aesthetically, because I was watching The Godfather Part III, and I was thinking about the way it works. What sequels do is turn movies into television, and not in the usual way that people think of when I say television, but as this sort of cheaper, flimsier form. I mean, the way people misinterpret television, I often hear people say, after seeing one episode of a show, "Oh, I didn't like it," and that's that. You can't do that with television, because television is something you have to live with week after week. The way it works is not whether one show is good or bad, but whether the characters sink into you and make you sort of desirous of joining them again on a regular basis. And sequels, oddly enough, have a little of the same thing, so that you could go to a real piece of crud like Rocky V and still have moments when emotions were awakened in you, not by anything that was on the screen, but by what you were reminded of off the screen that you had already experienced. So sequels give you this feeling of tuning in on the characters you left only a little while ago, and that can create really deep emotions, whether those emotions are earned by the movie or not.
Well, thanks a lot for reviewing the year for us in film. I wish you a very happy New Year, Stephen.
Same to you, Terry.
And I wish you some good movies to, to go see in 1991.
Really, yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic and critic at large for Vanity Fair. Today we're looking back on the year with some of our critics. We asked book critic John Leonard to talk about his favorite books of the year and to review some of the more important events of the year in the literary world. One of the big publishing stories of 1990 was the shakeup at Pantheon. The head of the company, Andre Schifrin, resigned under pressure, and five of his editors resigned in protest after Schifrin refused to cut back his staff and the number of books he published. Pantheon is a subsidiary of Random House, which is owned by a media conglomerate. Many people in the literary world interpreted the Pantheon story as evidence that conglomerate ownership cared more about the bottom line than publishing quality books. John Leonard says it's too soon to tell what the long-term consequences will be for Pantheon, but they have hired some good new editors.
But what kind of fascinates me is why these people who are getting into publishing, these bottom-line people and these bean counters, why they should do so in the first place. Publishing, even in its fat years, never yielded the kinds of profits that we expect from big and successful corporations. If people really want to make a lot of money, I just wonder why they don't do something else. You know, why go into this business, which is of itself messy, irrational, guessing, staffed largely by editors who themselves are trying to satisfy the English teacher who changed their lives way back in high school, who have a different set of ideals. You don't really go into publishing for the money, or you shouldn't. And if it's money you're interested in, there are lots of other ways to make it.
Now, a current controversy in publishing has to do with Bret Easton Ellis's new novel, American Psycho. Mm-hmm. And Ellis is a young writer in his 20s who wrote the book Less Than Zero, upon which the movie of the same name was based. There's a lot of graphic scenes, apparently, of torturing and dismembering of women. Simon & Schuster dropped the book just a few weeks before it was scheduled to be published, and Knopf recently picked it up. Have you read excerpts of the book or the book itself yet?
I have only read the excerpts, if you could even call them excerpts, because they were so minimal, that appeared in Time magazine and in Spy. And then I've read the various articles by people who seem to have read a little more. Roger Rosenblatt claims in the Times to have read a third of it. It's not clear which third. And there have been several other dispatches from the front. I'm reluctant to talk about the book not having read it. However, on the basis of Bret Easton Ellis's first two books, the second one of which I reviewed for Fresh Air, I don't think we're talking about a person of talent. I think we're talking about a desperate career move. And it certainly sounds objectionable to me. But everything else that's raised by this is more interesting than any book I think Ellis himself will ever manage to write.
You know, Los Angeles now is organizing a boycott against Random House, which is the parent company of Knopf.
I consider this to be foolishness of a high order. I don't think we're talking, in the instance of Ellis, about some flaming case of censorship. I think any publishing house has a right to decide what book it wants to publish. If a corporation, having gotten bad publicity, decides to cut back on an artifact of any sort to protect itself, this is discouraging, but it's not as though a writer is being silenced, especially since the book has been picked up by somebody else. Now, why that book was picked up by somebody else is another question. Is that just for money, or is Sonny Mehta at Knopf convinced that there's literary merit here? Then, to take it further and to have something like Now and other boycotts attacking Random House, instead of saying, I refuse to read this particular book, seems to me censorship in the making of a peculiar and obnoxious sort. I mean, Random House, Knopf publishes, just for instance, Toni Morrison and Garcia Marquez. Are we not supposed to buy these books because we're protesting the decision of an editor there to publish a book that we don't like? We become morons if we participate in something like that. You don't buy a book. You don't read a book if you don't want to, or you read it and throw it away and you don't review it. I certainly don't review all the books that I read. You do not say that it shouldn't be published. You do not say that other people shouldn't read it. You do not say that anybody who publishes it, we will boycott other products of that person. Because publishing is not like boycotting somebody who is giving you South African diamonds or Chilean grapes. It's a the basket that comes from a publishing house is a basket of individual writers, of individual talents, in many cases genius. To boycott them is to boycott yourself, is to boycott your own capacity to be changed by art. So I just, I don't believe in any censorship, period. I believe in more free speech against objectionable free speech.
John, I know you spent some time in Eastern Europe this year. You traveled to Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. and Hungary. You spent a week and a half in Prague. Now, the president of Czechoslovakia now is the playwright Václav Havel. Mm-hmm. How do you think the peaceful revolutions in Eastern Europe have affected culture there? What's your reading on that?
Well, the complaint in both Czechoslovakia and Hungary is that serious Czechoslovakian writers and filmmakers, in particular, are now being a little neglected. What you notice, first of all, in the newsstands and the bookstores is a sudden influx of pornography and of other forms of mass market Western entertainment that are not nearly as noble or heroic as what the writers in Eastern Europe and the filmmakers in Eastern Europe were doing. This is one more wonderful dividend of the free market that provides you with as much bad taste as good taste, and the bad taste sells better. But this is not to say that something quite extraordinary hasn't happened. The nature of civic and political life in Prague is almost unimaginable to anyone from the United States.
I've been reading that some of the filmmakers and theater companies and art groups like that used to be subsidized by the communist governments, and they're not being subsidized by the new democracies. And ironically, some artists are finding it much more difficult to make a living in democracy.
I should imagine that's one part of it. Yes, there's always been an emphasis on certain kinds of culture and official subsidy for it. But that's not been the vital culture of the Eastern European countries. The vital culture has been a dissident culture. The vital culture has been in samizdat, and it's been in bootleg tapes, and it's been until the revolution of 89, you had to be licensed to be an artist in Czechoslovakia. And so where all the wit and the daring went was underground, and it was in hit and run, and it was in performance art on the Charles Bridge, or it was in secret lofts, and it was in books that were either published abroad and smuggled back into the country, or books that were circulated as samizdat is circulated in the Soviet Union. Now, to a degree, that kind of clandestine or dissident or underground culture has also suffered. There is a cachet, there is a glow to an art, to a culture that is opposed to the routine brutality and vacancy of the state. Your writer is taken very seriously because he or she has dared to risk jail or worse. Now, when anybody can say anything, there is no such daring, and therefore there is not quite the glamour that there was before. I think that the officially subsidized art of the Eastern European countries is something less to mourn than the vitality of an opposition culture. It seems to me that if something really new and strange and wonderful is to happen out of all this improvisation, it would be the kind of society that can embody its contradictions so that political life is not a question of party platforms, but of a continuing dialogue of people who are trying to define in front of us in art and in politics what are questions of social justice, what are questions of decency, how do we want to live as human beings, how do we want to connect to one another as human beings, and I don't know how long that will take or whether it'll happen.
John, we haven't had a chance to talk this year about your take on the National Endowment for the Arts controversy and the limitations on what the NEA can fund now, limitations in terms of perceived obscenity and homoeroticism.
Well, I think the National Endowment for the Arts has been crippled unto death. I think the resignation of many members of the literature panel, in particular, triggered this. What seems to have been going on is you had representatives of certain senators and certain members of Congress who would actually come into the NEA's office and go through their files, and they were looking for homosexuality and lesbianism. They were looking for some excuse to cripple the program. The integrity and the value of the NEA program depends entirely upon the integrity of the panels, and those are peer panels. And already we have seen the peer panels overruled for reasons that are never entirely clear, although we can suspect them, by the chairman of the endowment and nibbled to death by the Helmses of this world. And when that happens, we can stagger on, even with the cutbacks that were announced last week. We can stagger on for a while so that your symphony orchestras and your museums and your jazz programs and some of your dancing troops will continue to get desperately needed money. But when it's compromised at the base, when you take away the authority of the peer panel, you open up every decision that the endowment makes to politicizing. And it will cease to function in a way that will matter to the society.
We've only saved about 3 minutes for the remaining question. So, I'd like to know what your favorite books of 1990 have been. Do you have a list of your favorites?
Well, I can tell you some of them, yes. I have to admit, and it's kind of embarrassing, that the book that most delighted me, certainly the novel that most delighted me all year long, is one that I didn't review for Fresh Air. And when I got around to wanting to review it, it turned out you'd already reviewed it. Fortunately, you loved it as much as I did. But that's A.S. Byatt's Possession, which I found to be just wickedly delightful about romantic love in the face of literary theory and recreating the entire 19th century and all those poems that were written and all those legends that were written. It was just a delight. But looking back otherwise, I still like, from the very beginning of the year, Anne Beattie's Picturing Will is a novel that sticks with me. And that's the difference between serious fiction, it seems to me, and the rest of the popular culture that we all review, is that after the distractions and after the excitement and after the bedazzlings, what do you remember? And I remember the characters from Anne Beattie, and I remember the characters from Toby Olson's Dorrit and Lesbos, and I remember Mordecai Richler and J.M. Coetzee's The Age of Iron, and I still like the Vonnegut a lot. And I find, looking back, I'm a little disappointed in what residue has been left in me from Pynchon's Vineland and from the Garcia Marquez, I think, is one of his weaker novels. And I thought the Updike was overstuffed. And the Nadine Gordimer was not as good as the Coetzee, if we're just talking strictly South African novels. That seems like such a laundry list. To go back to Czechoslovakia, when nonfiction is concerned, Timothy Garton Ash's The Magic Lantern is a wonderful book, because here was an English scholar and reporter who happened to be on hand in Poland and in Germany and in Czechoslovakia and in Hungary when the bottom fell out and the stars came out. And it's just terrific stuff. And so are Barbara Ehrenreich's essays, The Worst Years of Our Lives. And I loved, and judging from the mail from Fresh Air listeners, so did a lot of people, this strange book, Lucy Hughes Hallett's Cleopatra, sort of a revisionist view of, well, the images of Cleopatra throughout the ages and what that tells us about the men who make the images. And I also loved Harry Petrosky's book on the pencil, because it's just full of stuff that I didn't know, and that's one of the reasons I read.
Well, John, I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, thanks. It's been nice talking to you.
John Leonard is Fresh Air's book critic and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.